First case is 98287, State of Ohio versus Sheriff James.
Our buddy.
Mr. Bradley.
Who's your buddy?
Court, Jack Bradley, along with Renee Green, we're representing Mr. Filiaggi. Mr. Chief Justice, I would ask for permission to split my argument 20 minutes and 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there, the clock.
That the court has a very important issue to decide in this case, and that is whether or not a defendant who is facing a death penalty is competent to stand trial. And in this particular case, I think that there were some serious issues that were raised at the beginning of this trial that warranted additional evaluations of Mr. Filiaggi before the court made a determination as to whether or not he was competent. In this case, through no fault of Mr. Filiaggi, stun type belt placed upon him to bring him to court each day. And on the first day of trial, before the trial even began, the stun belt accidentally went off. According to Judge Zaleski, who was the judge hearing the case at that time, he found that this was due to the incompetence of someone in the sheriff's department. The judge observed the defendant was brought to court and he was shaken. The judge also observed that the defendant may have been placed on Valium at that time. So the court, at that particular point, recessed the trial until 1 o'clock in the afternoon so that Mr. Filiaggi could be treated. That afternoon, Mr. Filiaggi was brought back to court, and he then waived his right to be tried by a jury and elected to be tried by a three-judge panel. The judge did review with Mr. Filiaggi his waivers in open court. The judge did not enter into any type of a meaningful discussion with Mr. Filiaggi as to whether or not he knew what a waiver of jury trial would mean in a capital murder case. The trial continued that particular day. Witnesses were heard. The following day, July 12th of 1995, Mr. Filiaggi's attorney, Mr. Burge, indicated to the court that he felt that Mr. Filiaggi was not competent to continue in the trial, that he had serious reservations about whether or not Mr. Filiaggi understood the nature of the charges against him and whether or not he could assist his counsel in the defense. At that point, Judge Zaleski decided that it would be warranted to have Mr. Filiaggi examined by the court's psychologist, Dr. Hagen. And so the trial was recessed at that point, and Dr. Hagen was ordered to undertake an evaluation of Mr. Filiaggi. There was some indication that the trial would resume in the afternoon after Dr. Hagen had done his evaluation. As it turns out, nothing else was done on July 12th, and the trial reconvened on July 13th. At that time, Dr. Hagen testified. Dr. Hagen indicated on direct examination that he felt that Mr. Filiaggi was competent to stand trial, that he did understand the nature of the charges against him, and also that he was able to assist his counsel. On cross-examination, it turns out that Dr. Hagelin's opinion was not as strong as it may have been indicated on direct examination. He indicated that he thought that he should do a further evaluation of Mr. Filiaggi, and that his opinion was that the trial should not continue at that point, and that he would feel more comfortable doing a second evaluation. Nevertheless, Judge Zaleski found that a second evaluation would not be warranted based upon the direct examination, the direct testimony of Dr. Hagelin, and that the trial would proceed. It's interesting to note that Dr. Hagelin specifically indicated that he did not feel that Mr. Filiaggi was malingering, and that his evaluation was based upon observations that he felt were truthful and not something that the defendant was faking. The defense did ask the judge to consider further testimony by having Mr. Filiaggi examined by his own treating psychiatrist and also his treating physician. This was denied. Revised Code 29-4537 provides the procedure to protect the rights of a defendant to be tried only when they are competent to stand trial.
What other testimony does the court take? Please refer to prison guards or officers that were charged with security?
As the trial proceeded, Attorney Burge continued to indicate to the court that he felt and that his co-counsel felt that Mr. Filiaggi was not able to participate in his defense, that he did not understand the nature of the charges against him, that he was unable to relate what was happening each day during the trial. And so at certain points, the judge would either have the prosecutor indicate information that he learned from corrections officers or sheriff's deputies who transported or observed Mr. Filiaggi, or the judge actually heard testimony from the sheriff's deputy and corrections officers. But this was throughout the trial.
And their testimony indicated that when he was out in the presence of the trial court, he behaved normally, did he not?
Yes.
So I didn't see any of the type of evidence that you're referring to, either in fact, drinking, eating, showering, being fine.
I think the significance is that the thing that was triggering Mr. Filiaggi's reactions and incompetence was the fact that when Dr. Hagelin went out to interview him initially, he kept talking about having been stunned or receiving the shot from the stun belt more than one time. Mr. Filiaggi indicated to Dr. Hagelin that the deputies, the corrections officers, had continuously shot him, that they were going to shock him again. And so the second day of trial, they attempted...
Any evidence of that beyond his claim?
There's no evidence of that. It was just what Dr. Hagelin said was Mr. Filiaggi's perception. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that he was shot more than one time. But Dr. Hagelin testified that he felt that Mr. Filiaggi had this belief. So, in the morning...
And the judge can assess whether that's credible or not, or whether that's an attempt to make more of a bad situation than it is.
That's correct. But one thing that's important is this, is that they continued to place a belt around Mr. Filiaggi where his handcuffs were shackled to this belt, and then a chain ran from that belt to his feet. And the indication is that whenever this was attempted, that Mr. Filiaggi would then start to react, would become upset, would become agitated, because he felt that this was another attempt to put some type of a stun belt on him, and therefore shock him again. Right, but what happened is during the trial, when they had these shackles on him, that's when his attorneys weren't able to communicate with him, that's when his attorneys couldn't rationalized with him when they felt that he was incompetent. And at one point during the trial, the judge actually had the deputy remove the shackle from him so that when he was sitting there at trial, that shackle was removed. And I think that is at least some kind of realization by the judge that maybe this shackle was having the effect of having Mr. Miliagi believe that he might be stunned again and therefore was causing him to go into this state. The defense attorneys continuously throughout this trial, at least the first week of the trial, the first 4 days of the trial, informed the judge that they were not able to communicate with this defendant during the time that he was in court, and that he did not appear to understand what was going on during the trial when he was in court. Because a person comes to trial or comes to the courthouse, eats breakfast, goes to sleep, and does normal things when they're not shackled, doesn't mean that that person's competent. I don't think a sheriff's deputy is the person who should determine whether or not a person is competent to stand trial. I don't think the observations of the sheriff's deputy are any greater than the observations of the defense attorney in determining whether the defendant is competent or not competent. It appears in this case that the judge placed much greater weight on the representations of the sheriff's deputies and the corrections officers than the judge placed upon the defense attorneys, who were indicating that not only were they unable to communicate with him, not only did they believe he didn't understand the nature of the charges against him, but that one of his attorneys, who was a physician, was monitoring his vital signs and determined that his pulse rate was raised, his respiration rates were raised, and that these were things that could not be done on your own, that these were things that were not controlled by the defendant, but signs that they felt buttressed their observations of him being not competent. So in this particular case, all that was asked is let Dr. Hagelin have a second evaluation, because that's what he wanted to do. And a hearing had already started in this particular case. I don't think there's any issue as to whether or not a hearing to determine the defendant's competency was instituted in this case. There was a hearing. The judge ordered Dr. Hagelin to have Mr. Miliagi examined, and then had Dr. Hagelin testify and started a hearing.
Let's say we agree with you, what's your referee?
The referee is a new trial. I mean, you're not going to place a person in, I mean, this court even recognized that in the Berry case, that we're not going to have a person who is incompetent during their trial given a death penalty. If he was incompetent during this trial, then he has to be granted a new trial. I mean, at a minimum, the death sentence should be vacated. I don't know how we can say that there was a fair trial for a person who was not competent. And all that was requested is let Dr. Hagelin, who seemed to be confused as to whether or not this trial should proceed, have a second evaluation, and then the defense said, and let us have our psychiatrist and our treating physician examine him so that additional information can be given to the courts. I don't think that was such an inconvenience or such a stretch when we're talking about this type of a case. And the defense attorneys, I mean, there were manifestations during the entire trial that we can't communicate with him. He doesn't understand what's going on here when he's in court. It doesn't matter what happens to him when he's at jail. It doesn't matter what happens to him when he's been transported to and from the court. What matters...
It doesn't matter on issues of credibility. The court believes that he's not... maybe stuck after he has time to recover. I mean, you know, you certainly had a first day of trial after he was shot where there didn't be any problems at all. And that doesn't seem a bit medically that he would be shocked. He'd be fine, go through, you enter a waiver jury trial, you have a whole day of evidence, and all from the second day, it all shows up.
You know,
that just makes it better.
It's interesting that Dr. Hagelin, who the court found was credible, and when the court found, made a determination on direct examination that Mr. Filiaggi was competent, also testified that it was his opinion that Mr. Filiaggi was not malingering.
Not malingering, he's competent. Now you interpret that to say, okay, he's not malingering, that he's therefore incompetent. I mean,
no, I'm just saying that how do you, to give a defendant a hearing means to give him a full hearing. It doesn't mean to give him part of the hearing. It doesn't mean, well, we're only going to consider what the expert said on direct examination. The right confrontation has no meaning if we're just going to say a defendant only is allowed to have the benefit of the doctor's direct examination, but we're not going to give any weight to the cross-examination when the doctor says, I think that the trial should not proceed. I believe that there are emotional components to competency, and I believe that I need to evaluate this defendant further to see what he's like today, to see if this trial should proceed. Then the defense says, the judge, we'd like to have him examined by our psychiatrist, our treating physician, and present that information to the court. A hearing had already started, but no, the hearing was short-circuited, and there was no meaningful hearing. There was a hearing where the judge determined, no, we're going to proceed with this trial. We don't need any further information.
Is that the first time defense counsel requested that they present their evidence?
Yes.
Why?
That would have been the appropriate time. I mean, the judge recessed the trial and said, we're going to have, the defense raised competency. The judge said, fine, we're going to have him examined by Dr. Hagelin.
The question I have is about the defense wanting to put their own psychiatrist on. Is that correct?
Well, no, the defense asked the judge, Judge, can we have a recess so that our psychiatrist and our physician can examine Mr. Filiaggi?
They had no idea of doing that before this hearing?
No, not according to the record. And there's no indication that they ever attempted to have Mr. Filiaggi examined for competency by their own experts prior to this hearing. But we're talking about the stunt was done on the 11th. I understand. He waived his right to a jury trial on the 11th in the afternoon after having been stunned. But there's no indication in the record that when he was brought back to court after going to the hospital on the 11th that he was in shackles. There's no indication whether or not he had been medicated with Valium. It was certainly the judge's impression that he had been given Valium. Now, I understand that there's nothing in the record to show that Mr. Filiaggi was given Valium on the 11th. But it was the judge who was deciding the issue of competency's opinion that this man had been given Valium. Well, maybe that fact should have been considered by the judge on the afternoon of the 11th in having Mr. Filiaggi sit there, listen to the testimony of witnesses, waive his right to a trial, and if the judge felt that this man had been medicated with Valium, maybe that was an indication that on the 12th, when Dr. Hagelin talked to him, that maybe he wasn't on Valium anymore, and maybe then his competency came into question.
Let me take you to another issue. The claim that three judges tried the defect and only Judge Lindsay tried the issues that were not death. Let's say we didn't find that error. What's the remedy? We just said those cases,
the case back only on those particular charges, and I know I'm probably arguing against myself here, but if you send it back, then you're just going to have one judge decide those issues anyhow. So,
now, well, I just remember that all three judges are still sitting. If you send it back, if they heard all the evidence related to the other charges, well, you send it back, that will reach a determination of the charges and the three judges.
all three judges are still available to determine this case. I think the statute is clear that the statute says the accused shall not be found guilty or not guilty of any offense unless the judges unanimously find the accused guilty or not guilty. So they're not just talking about the death part of the case. When you elect to have a three-judge panel, the statute says that they have to unanimously agree on all the charges and all the offenses. And if you're going to send it back, I think that, again, it warrants a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Bradley. Mr. Rosenbaum.
Yeah, I think it's paramount to bear in mind at this juncture what actually took place in this trial. And the first thing I would like to point out to the court, as I'm sure is aware, is that the Court of Appeals specifically found that there was no request for a hearing in this matter. And indeed, questioned in a footnote whether the issue as to whether the court failed to hold a hearing on the defendant's conduct was even properly before it. But more importantly, the defendant is presumed competent unless he can rebut that presumption on his own. Now, the defendant, as this court has already pointed out, finds himself in the unfortunate position of having come to court for half a day's testimony, 8 witnesses without a complaint. In that appearance in court, he took the very important step of waiving his right to a jury trial with the blessing of his three lawyers, one of whom was a physician. There was not even an inkling that something was wrong at that time. The defendant had to be transported to court prior to that in a manner that is consistent with always with how the sheriff transports defendants. Mr. Bradley has pointed out that the record does not say that at that time he was shackled, but I think it's a pretty far stretch to conclude the opposite, that he was brought to court one time unshackled after the stunning incident, but that later on he was put on the waist belt with the usual precautions taken for violent offenders. The defendant had the burden of proof in this issue. The defendant at this point had his argument to this court that the trial court abused its discretion, that his actions were unconscionable. And in light of the record, I think that would be very hard and improper for this court to find. I would like to point out that on page 132 of the transcript, it's quite clear that the trial court gave Mr. Birch an opportunity to call any other witnesses, and he did not. I think it is also important to note from the record that the defendant, or one of the key aspects of the defense in this case, was that the defendant was unable to control his conduct because he suffered from low levels of serotonin. The defendant attempted to illustrate that by calling a psychiatrist to stand and said, "I have successfully treated him for that. We have given him medication which has elevated his levels of serotonin, and therefore he has responded without these violent outbursts, and this proves our original claim that he was not responsible for his actions due to a chemical imbalance." But the converse of that coin is that he had an untreated psychiatrist the entire time. At no way, shape, or form did they make an effort to call him to stand. Defense counsel today stands before you, or appellate counsel, and argues that he was not given the opportunity to have his own lawyer look, or his own psychiatrist look at him. I say to you that is contradicted by the record. The defendant, as the record is replete, had instances when he was out of court to meet with the psychiatrist, to confer with his lawyers, to confer with ministers, to do stretching exercise, to eat, partake in the daily life of the jail. At some point in time, if the defense was serious about bringing experts to the court to support this claim of incompetence, they could have had their psychiatrist, which was already involved as a member of the defense team for a period of months, if not a year prior to this trial, to come in and say, "I have examined him, Your Honor." The defense counsel would stand up and say, "Our psychiatrist has examined him, and we have something additional to offer to the court."
You're saying that the most defense counsel asked for was time to have the defendant examined by a psychiatrist, whereas he'd already had sufficient examinations that the psychiatrist could have testified. Is that true?
Yes.
But how would that you have a psychiatrist that just seen him before this guy ended, how could he render, how could he qualify to render an opinion on his mental state after the study without another exam?
Well, I think he could do another exam, but my point is that he could have easily done it, at least preliminarily, while they were out of court. And that was not done. There is no effort for the defense counsel to say that the psychiatrist had examined him, Your Honor, and the psychiatrist disputes Dr. Hagelin's conclusions, no matter how ambiguous the defense may interpret them to be.
My understanding of the brief was that they asked at the time, and you can't just call a psychiatrist and come over to visit this one. The error wasn't worked that way.
They
asked for time to have it.
When you have a defense counsel, a psychiatrist is already part of the defense team, has to testify, has examined this man, has been treating him the entire time and medicating him, I don't think it would be unreasonable to expect the defense to make some preliminary showing to say that our onboard psychiatrist concurs with our opinion that he is incompetent and contrary to the court specifically finding that he is malingering. That was not done here. And I guess I offer that as an illustration that I don't believe this was a real effort in any way, shape, or form to do anything. The state made many representations to show that the defendant was behaving normally in jail between recesses and any other time, as you have pointed out, other than in court. And when given the opportunity to refute these allegations, the only thing they brought forward was the assertions of counsel. And what the defense is really asking here today is to say that the involved assertions of counsel are enough to contradict what the court's own observations and the court's experts is saying in an abuse of discretion standard that should not be heard.
The court's experts on fraud seem to really backtrack and seem to indicate he was not quite certain that the case we should have more time to look at it at the end.
I don't agree with that. He said that he would be more comfortable or happier with another examination. He did not offer any opinion whatsoever that he could not act as a client, he could not assist in the defense, he did not appreciate the nature and consequences of what was going on in the proceedings. In fact, he said he wasn't out there this morning, but the limited information he had on that morning was he talked to the jail social worker and that Mr. Filiaggi had spent a good night, had a breakfast, and was in pretty good shape. I think Dr. Hagelin was being over conservative when he said he would like to see him again. There was no evidence to the contrary, and the trial proceeded, and the trial court specifically found that the defendant was malingering when he rejected the defendant's motions for a new trial. And I don't think that based on the record as it exists, that is an abuse of discretion.
Mr. Rosenbaum, I don't want to suggest how prosecutors should try their cases, but what would the reason be for a prosecutor not to just say, sure, have him examined so that we protect the record on appeal? Here we've got a major issue on appeal that really easily could have been prevented, it seems to me. Is it just the usual, we'll take what we can get on the trial level and worry about the appeal later? It would have been very simple here, it seems to me. Maybe I'm underestimating how simple it would be, but you could have protected the record by having him examined. Let him take a day or whatever it takes to trial judge. Is he calendar not to permit that? Or well, I mean after when he was requested, when they requested him, then after he was done.
No one has to say they would object to this panel. Pretty adamant about proceeding. The panel gave them an examination with no objection to the state, and properly so. What you're really asking me is, should they have a second and a third examination?
Didn't the court also have the testimony of the people that were around this defendant, the corrections officers, on an ongoing basis, reporting back to the court about his behavior and what he was doing? And wasn't that conclusion that he was acting normal? And the reason that the court did not grant that second psychiatric examination is because there was no basis for it. This particular defendant was acting in a normal way.
I think what you're saying is accurate, but I don't want to mislead the court. You used the word testimony. What happened was the state, through myself, was prepared to offer.
No, I didn't say testimony, I said reporting to the judge.
Absolutely, there was reporting. I made representations about his condition from what I could gather, happened at the jail the night before. The state was prepared to call witnesses. The defense never refuted them or said we dispute that. There was no need for a hearing. There was never a request for a hearing. So what you have here is, and especially in light of the fact that he was transported to court in the usual manner, eight witnesses were testified, the same lawyer as normally permitted him to waive his valuable right to a trial by jury. The next morning, all of a sudden, he's incompetent. I don't think the court was out of line when he gave it his one examination. Dr. Higman said that he understood the nature of the proceedings against him and that the trial went forward.
Counsel, was there some evidence that this defendant was planning to take his own life?
No. What do you mean, at trial? During this time?
Okay. At the time of the incident?
At the part of the defense?
Yes.
The defendant, the claim of the psychiatrist was, or the defense claim was that he suffered from low serotonin levels, that he flew into what they categorize as a white rage, and to explain why he would go over there with the gun he just purchased, the defense offered testimony that he really intended to kill himself when he got there and inflict the ultimate psychological trauma on him, which the state refuted quite clearly.
What evidence did you present of the reason that he shot his ex-wife?
Revenge, vengeance. She was going to testify against him. He could not get her back. Jealousy. He had been stalking her. He had been harassing her. He had been ex-wife.
Which theory is it?
It's all of the above. He made this woman's life just totally miserable. He could not live without her. That is why the state was
offered. Some of them are death specifications, and some of the theories are not.
Well, motive can be broader than the death specification, and it was. But the death specification.
What testimony did you offer that he went over there and shot her to avoid her testimony at the trial?
Well, he was. 2 days before, he was videotaped throwing an object, attempting to throw an object through her front window, but he had done it so many times that they replaced the plexiglass and put up a video camera at the front window.
Was there any direct evidence of him telling anyone that he wanted to either scare her through these other acts that you pointed, or that he wanted to take her life to avoid her testimony?
As he pulled the trigger, he said in front of his neighbor, this will teach you to help with me.
And that's it. That's your only direct evidence on the death specification.
Well, I guess I don't understand what you mean by direct. She was a witness in two matters that were already pending before him. Trial was coming up. He'd been caught red-handed again. 2 days after, he commits another crime. And she's a witness, and he kills her.
He hated her guts. He was obsessed by her. Those motives that you just said, articulated, don't fit the death sentence.
I would think that he could hate her because she was a witness testifying against him. If you're asking me to say that there are inferences that could be drawn based upon a partial view of the evidence, I have to concede that. But on the other side of that coin is the trial court heard the evidence, convicted on both, and then there is the spec also of the person who attempted to kill two or more people as well.
And what's good about that? What, after he killed her, he wanted to.
He left the city of Lorain, which is the township of Amherst, forced his way into his father-in-law's house, pulled out a gun and said, are you ready to die? I'm going to kill you. Because of all the trouble they had had with him, he answered the door with a can of mace, ready to defend as the gun was coming up. The defendant fired twice. He fled his life.
That would fit.
Absolutely.
Was there testimony that he went there to kill his stepfather-in-law?
His father-in-law, I heard.
Was his father-in-law, not stepfather?
I believe he was his father-in-law. Lisa Filiati, who's probably, hey, you're right, Mrs. Yetko was Lisa's mother, Adrian Merritt.
I thought there was some indication he went there to kill her mother.
She was not home.
But was there testimony that that was his purpose for going there?
Finally, defense counsel addressed the issue of whether the three judges versus one judge properly heard the non-capital crimes. I submit to the court that even if there was error here, which I believe is a reasonable interpretation of the statute, does not require the three-judge panel to hear the other crimes. A reading of the transcript of page 11 will reveal that Judge Zaleski clearly said that I would be the one trying the other cases. The defense agreed and did not object to that.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenbaum. Mr. Bradley, you've saved almost 10 minutes of your time.
It sounds like they're going to make the judge abide by the statute. The judge just doesn't abide by it.
The first thing that Mr. Rosenbaum raised was the indication by the Court of Appeals that there was no request for a hearing in this case, and therefore the defense had waived that particular issue. We're not raising the request for hearing because there was a hearing in this case. We're just saying that the hearing that was conducted was not a complete hearing. Once you have Dr. Hagelin examine Mr. Filiaggi and then have him come to court and testify on direct and cross-examination, you have a hearing. Now, I don't think it was unreasonable for the defense, after Dr. Hagelin said, well, yes, I'm finding him competent yesterday, but today I'm not so sure. I think I better get another evaluation. I mean, Dr. Hagelin's testimony was very clear. He said he was rather hesitant about the trial continuing. He didn't think he was able to continue the trial based on his mental state. He felt a further examination that day would be a good idea. Judge Zaleski said, no, not going to do that. Mr. Bergson said, well, Judge, can I then have my psychiatrist, my treating physician, to examine Mr. Filiaggi? He's in jail. I mean, it's not like you just take him over to your psychiatrist and have him examined. There are procedures that have to be followed to get someone examined. Mr. Birch asked the court's permission, can we set this up? Can I get my psychiatrist over there to see Mr. Filiaggi, who's in jail, who's shackled? And then we may have knocked out, Mr. Birch's psychiatrist or Mr. Filiaggi's psychiatrist may have said, well, no, I find him competent. Well, then he wouldn't have had anything to offer. But he never got that opportunity because the judge said, no, we're not going to hear any more testimony, Mr. Burge. You don't have anything at this point, and we're not going to give you an opportunity to have him examined. That's the end of it. Dr. Hagelin on direct said he's competent, and I don't care that Dr. Hagelin has some problems today and would like a further examination, and that you want your psychiatrist to examine. No, we're continuing with this trial. Even though at that point there was no indication that Mr. Filiaggi was faking anything. As a matter of fact, Dr. Hagelin's testimony was that on the morning of the second day of trial, when the officers tried to put a belt on him again, the defendant flew into a rage and the situation escalated out of control. It was Mr. Filiaggi's perception that they would put that stun belt on him.
Well, that certainly would indicate incompetence. I mean, he had a bad experience with the stunt belt. He was simply acting in the normal way. He didn't want it on again.
Jesus.
We have a representation from his attorney after that incident that now the defendant is not communicating with us in court, and he doesn't apparently understand what's going on. And Dr. Hagelin is saying, I think we better get another evaluation, either by me or Mr. Berger saying, by our psychiatrist. I mean, I agree. I don't think it's that difficult to have a further evaluation and to have a complete hearing. There was a hearing in this case. There was no waiver of any hearing. There was no need to request a hearing. The judge had a hearing pursuant to the statute. And yes, Mr. Rosenbaum is correct. The burden is upon the defense. The judge knows that. They have to show by a preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Biliotti is not competent. You don't do that by simply calling the court's expert who is vacillating, and then when the defense says, well, we want our experts to have a chance to look at him, and the judge says, no way, to say that's a fair hearing.
Is there any request to offer evidence regarding the impact or the effect that a stun will do to somebody?
No.
Having something?
And I understand. There was no testimony that he received 50,000 volts, but there was in the affidavit of Mr. Burge for the motion for new trial. But there was a recognition by Judge Zaleski on the first day of trial that the defendant appeared shaken. He said when he had Mr. Filiaggi examined that, I think we're going to have this defendant examined so we can see if he can continue with the trial or if he needs to be hospitalized. And I think he's on Valium. So the judges recognized the fact that whatever this stun belt did, it had some significant effect on the defendant, enough of an effect that I want him examined, I want to see if he needs hospitalization, and I think they got him on Valium. And yes, that afternoon, you signed the waiver of your right to a jury trial. You understand it? Yes. That's it. And maybe it would have been a good idea for the judge, after the competency determination, to ask Mr. Filiaggi again. Now, Mr. Filiaggi, you know, 2 days ago, you waived your right to a jury trial, but I had a little bit of a doubt about whether you were competent or not, so I had you examined. Now I've determined you are competent. Maybe I better address that issue of your waiver of a jury trial again to make sure that you did know what you were doing here. But no, he didn't do that either. Even though the attorney is saying, Judge, he's not competent. He doesn't understand what's going on. Now, don't you think after that point would have been a good time to ask him again if he understood, if he knew what he was doing and waiving his right to a jury trial? No, that wasn't done. I think there's error in the way this trial began. I think there's error in whether or not this defendant was competent. I don't think the judge gave the defense an opportunity to carry their burden of preponderance of the evidence. In this case, has to be returned back to the court so that this man can receive a trial when we know that he is competent. And there's still a question there as to whether he was competent or not. We may say, well, we got a lot of reports, got a lot of indications that he was acting normally. But if we're going to allow corrections officers and prosecutors' representations to determine competency, then we might as well do away with the statute and say we don't need experts and we don't need reports, because all of us can determine if somebody's competent or not.
Is he competent now?
I don't know. All I can tell you is, the next time they put a belt on him, a restraint belt on him, they bring him to court, then that's when an expert will be able to determine whether or not he's competent. But that issue has to be determined based upon the testimony of experts, and the defense has to have a fair opportunity to provide that information to the court.
So your theory is he really needs to be examined with a gun belt on.
That belt?
That
is
the only time
you
get that.
I think that would be, well, I mean, Dr. Hagman felt that way. He said, I'd like to see him again this morning. I don't think we should continue with this trial. That's the judge's expert. So, I don't think that it's such a stretch to allow the defense to have an exam. Maybe we had another day's continuance of this trial to allow that to happen. We've got a three-judge panel. We're not inconveniencing a jury. We've already wasted one day by having Dr. Hagman examine him. We've wasted a half a day by having Dr. Hagman testify.
Counsel, before you sit down, I want to take you to something that you have not typically touched on, which you raised in a proportionality review, and you indicate there is a serious problem with the data bank being accumulated here in the Supreme Court because trial courts are not issuing findings of facts when there is not the imposition of the death penalty.
That's correct.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit? What you might suggest we do to correct that deficiency?
It appears that in cases where a life sentence is imposed, that the court is not making that independent analysis, and therefore those types of decisions are not available for review by the Ohio Supreme Court. And I think that a directive has to be sent out, and I think the best kind of directive is to send this case back for a new trial, or at a minimum, for the specific findings, well, not in this case, but any of those cases that involve life sentences, and say that these cases have to have these kind of decisions. In a case like this,
it is clear the statute contemplates the collection of data of all cases in which there is an indictment with death specifications, and then a tracking of outcome for comparison of those in which the death is imposed with those cases in which death is not imposed.
I guess the problem, honestly, is that this court has found that the courts only have to consider those cases when death was imposed in making their proportionality review, and therefore the trial judges have found that why should we make that ruling since the Supreme Court is not requiring us to look at life sentence.
But the statute mandates.
The statute mandates it, and I think the court reverses its position, then we'll get those kind of decisions and maybe someday avoid some federal court overturning a death sentence based upon that fact that he's stayed alive.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bradley. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.